Yeah, we're talking about what is some of the alternative theories behind some of the things we take for granted. Not only just Christmas, New Year's, but well, how did all this St. Nicholas thing started? How did these traditions get to where they got? And that is what we're talking about with Jan Irvin. We're talking about the evidence of psychoactive elements in the formation of Judeo-Christianity, astrotheology, and shamanism, and we're going to get right back into it right after this. Welcome back to Coast AM. And Jan, right before the break, we were talking about Saint Nick and the legend of Santa Claus and how it kind of evolved and morphed. I mean, it really was a conglomeration of a lot of different traditions from a lot of different countries.
Absolutely. And Saint Nicholas himself even has a bit of a fascinating story around him. Saint Nicholas is said to have died on December 6th in the 4th century, which is the day of the Epiphany in the Orthodox Church. And his day is celebrated as the Feast of Altar Boys, or wherein a boy bishop was chosen as a sort of king for a day, reminiscent of the old pagan idea of king for a day, or the fool of the day, whatever, that was sacrificed. However, the boy bishop, his life was spared. And Saint Nicholas was also the patron saint of children, prostitutes, thieves, and sailors. And so
It's quite a
a
mix.
little bit, what's that? Quite a mix, yeah. So, at not really what we're told about with this character and how he relates into the Christmas story, but because he's the patron saint of children, the Catholic Church sort of placed him over top on the sort of the figure of Baba Yaga and the shamanic figure, and kind of put it all together into a new package that was consumable for their market, basically.
Yeah, and the idea of this is something that's not new. How things get turned into something else. How what we understand today could have come from something completely different. We see this, repeated all over. I mean, this is just an effect of how things get distorted, trends, sensibilities. What was wrong 100 years ago is now right, and vice versa.
Right, and I think it also has a lot to do with things that were, word of mouth myths and stories that were passed down generation after generation for a society to get along and whatnot, eventually becomes a literal history that you have to believe is true and that the characters were real people, and then the essence of what the story is all about gets lost. But as I said at the beginning of the show, I think really by getting in and looking at the history of this tradition, of the Christmas tradition, of seeing where Santa Claus and Pelz Nikel or Krampus comes from, and understanding the history of these things, we really gain a much deeper appreciation for the whole Christmas season. Because, I mean, in ancient times, you literally thought that the sun, if it continued south, was never going to come back again, and all life on earth perished. And on Christmas morning, on the morning of December 25th, when you saw the Virgo, or saw the sun born between Virgo's legs on the horizon, which is the constellation of the Virgin, when you saw that alignment directly underneath the three wise men, Caspar, Melchior, and Balthazar, in the belt of Orion there, you knew that the sun was going to be reborn. So it was a time of celebration and gift giving. And I think that, interestingly, and we'll get into this more in a moment, one of the gifts that was commonly given was the inebriation of the mushroom. So you gave the mushroom for a present. And very interestingly, these types of mushrooms, the Amanita muscaria mushrooms, grow in a symbiotic relationship, or in a mycorrhizal symbiotic relationship, with many different types of trees, especially the evergreen trees. So here we have these brightly colored packages that appear magically overnight under the tree by Santa Claus. And likewise, the mushrooms, these bright colored packages, appear magically under the trees out in nature. So all of these stories can be traced back to things that we can find out in nature. And if we don't look at all of them so literally, and we look at the stories for what they imply and the symbolism behind it all, I think we're given a much more fulfilling story. And in fact, it's a story that we bring right into the middle of our living rooms year after year and pass down generation after generation. So it's a story that hasn't died, even if it's become completely commercialized.
Right. Well, how much of the New Testament do you accept? Do you think Jesus was a man? He walked around? Or do you find evidence that a lot of that is not how it happened?
Well, I think that looking at the history of the New Testament and everything, there is a lot less evidence of these people being historical, in my opinion, than there is of them being mythology. There was Joshua ben Nun, Joshua ben Pandera. There was a Caesar to many different characters that have been pointed out as key figures, and including the Teacher of Righteousness in the Dead Sea Scrolls, that have been suggested as all having been possible human characters that were all included into the Jesus character. But was he just one person? I don't think so. And in fact, you know, getting into Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the church admits, like on the St. Mark's Basilica website, that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are north, south, east, and west. It's the lion, the ox, the eagle, and man. It's, you know, the four directions and all of these different meanings that tie into all of the different layers of the mystery schools and everything. So, you know, maybe at one level of the mythology, we're looking at a human being. At another level of the mythology, we're looking at the experience or the attitude or the way of living that this being is trying to portray. And rather than going around killing everybody to force our literal idea of this interpretation on others, when we understand it as this experience of being good and not judging others, see, because, you know, at the time with the Jewish aspect of the religion, if you weren't Jewish, you weren't allowed into the religion. So, you know, it was the Christianity was an offshoot that allowed Jews and Gentiles to be a part of the new religion and to live in peace together. So this was something that was needed to end the fighting between the different religious factions and groups at the time. And so, you know, and I know a lot of religious historians would probably be pulling their hair out listening to me saying that there's not much evidence for Jesus as a historical character. But I think, you know, when people read John Allegro's work and Professor Robert Price's work and Earl Dougherty's work and Timothy Freck and Peter Gandy and D.M. Murdoch or Acharya S., you know, and many people love to attack Acharya S.'s books, saying that she doesn't provide any evidence in there. But I've yet to see anybody who's read her books actually make such a claim against her work, because her works are chock full of evidence that Jesus was not a historical figure. And in fact, I have a very interesting quote here that I think your audience would find very interesting. It's from a church father, Epiphanius, from the 4th century. And he says about this whole discussion that we've been having regarding the solstice and the sun and everything. This this text, by the way, was actually omitted, and it was missing for 1,000 years, and it wasn't published until the mid-1800s when they found an older copy of this text, which had this missing portion in it. And it says, "For the Savior was born during the 42nd year of the Roman Emperor Augustus, for these days as follows. Christ was born on the 8th before the Ides of January, 13 days after the winter solstice, the Epiphany, and the increase of the light of day. Greeks, I mean the idolaters, celebrate this day on the 8th before the calends of January. Romans call Saturnalia, Egyptians Cronia, and Alexandrians Cecilia. For this division between the signs of the zodiac, which is the solstice, comes on the 8th before the calends of January, and on the day begins to lengthen because the light is receiving its increase. And it completes a period of 13 days until the 8th before the Ides of January, the day of Christ's birth, with a 13th of an hour added each day. The Syrian sage Ephrem testified to this calculation in his commentaries when he said, quote, "Thus the advent of our Lord Jesus Christ, his birth in the flesh or perfect incarnation, which is called the Epiphany, was revealed after a space of 13 days from the beginning of the increase in light." So they're saying right here that this entire celebration and all of these different, and he even calls them idolaters, because they have the exact same celebration in the Greek, Egyptian, and Alexandrian cultures that later became the Christian celebration. So here's this 4th century church father telling us that this story existed and was completely widespread at the time.
Hmm. Well, let me ask you this. I mean, with all the medicinal uses for mushrooms, not just their mind-altering effects, but like cordyceps, and the fact that they can, a spore can travel through the universe and seed perhaps life on other planets, why isn't there more sort of religions or faiths that incorporate mushrooms as a grand cosmic symbol of God's ability to pass life throughout the universe?
Well, you know, and I know many of your listeners would pull their hair out if I said that I think Judeo-Christianity is just that, and I think that I published sufficient evidence in my book, The Holy Mushroom, Evidence of Mushrooms in Judeo-Christianity, to argue that, in fact, the mushroom was that. In fact, a friend of mine, before he died last year, was working on a book called The Most High, arguing that Christianity is just that. But I think around the world, you know, when we look at the Hindu religion and the Rig Vedas, I think that Soma was the mushroom or was cannabis or something to that effect. We have Teonanacatl in the Maya culture and Native Mexican religions that celebrated the mushroom. And as I mentioned earlier, we have the Ojibwa tribe up in Northern California. And there is evidence around the world that a religion did exist. But it's interesting that you bring this issue up, because the evidence that I published in my book, The Holy Mushroom, is strong enough for people to go out and make a legal defense that they should have the legal right to practice using mushrooms as their religion. But as far as I know, nobody's taken the evidence that I published. And I did publish a primary canonized Christian text in that book, as I mentioned earlier, that specifically discusses the holy mushroom.
Well, so give us an example of like a chapter and verse. Like, how come we have so much in the Old Testament, New Testament, but no specific mention or outright mentions of what you perceive as a dominant theme?
Well, you know, I think, if you look in like the Song of Solomon, even in the book of Genesis, things like mandrake are discussed, which are, in fact, entheogens or psychedelics. We can talk about ideas of the burning bush and things like that, the smoke burning inside the tabernacle. These are all allusions to this sort of thing. And in fact, in the story of the manna in the desert, when we look up the word desert or wilderness there in the Bible and cross-reference that word to Strong's Concordance, Midbar is defined as a cattle pasture whither cattle are driven. And so this could be a perfect allusion to these sort of practices. But we have to go into, and as I mentioned earlier, there is mention of it in the Jewish Kabbalah, in the book of Zohar, and in the Orthodox Church, we do have this canonized Christian text, the Epistle to the Renegade Bishops, that specifically do discuss the mushroom. So, you know, while it's not blatantly out there in the public, I think part of the mystery schools and part of just like in the Hermetic traditions and alchemical traditions was that these were mysteries for the initiates, and they had to work their way through the symbolism and decipherment and understanding, you know, things like the trivium and quadrivium, which are the ancient seven liberal arts that these mysteries were based on, before they could work into deciphering the higher mysteries in their complete form. So there are all of these allusions to it. And as I mentioned, you know, myself and a few other researchers like Professor John Rush or Professor Carl Ruck, we have literally thousands of images, Christian icons, found in churches and cathedrals all over the world, very clearly, and in ancient Christian texts, very clearly showing these things. So while it might not be directly out for the public and all, you know, the masses to see, or the profane, as they would have called them, it is there in the text, in the symbolism and iconography, if people go out and look for it.
It is there, and you mentioned the Kabbalah, which is, of course, some people call it Jewish mysticism. How forthright or openly did they talk about the mushroom or the symbology of it in the Zohar, in the books?
Well, if you'll give me a second, I can do a quick search and tell you where, if I can find this really quick.
Well, while you're looking for that, the reason I'm wondering that is because, in your opinion, which ancient text is the most blatant when it comes to this underlying theme of the importance of mushrooms in this in the religious context?
I would say that the one that's the most profound and out there, the more that we look at it and study it, is the Epistle to the Renegade Bishops. But this one in the Book of Zohar, it starts off, "The secret of secrets, out of the scorching noon of Isaac, out of the dregs of wine, a fungus emerged, a cluster, male and female together, red as a rose, expanding in many directions and paths. The male is called Samael. The female is always included within him." And so, you know, this right here is very telling. And when you get into, say, what we've put out in our book, Astrotheology and Shamanism, or what Professor Carl Ruck has published in some of his books on this topic, this is exactly the symbolism and everything like that John Allegro talked about. The mushroom represented both male and female. It was alluded to as wine, you know, the in the Epistle to the Renegade Bishops that I published, the holy mushroom comes and saves the Orthodox monks from the Roman invasion, from the Roman Catholics that were coming to take over I forget which island, one of the Three Finger Islands, St. Patmos Island, I believe is what it was. But they're coming to, you know, to close down or take over these monasteries, and they say that the holy mushroom comes and saves them from the Catholics, and that all were saved by the mere possibility of tasting the holy mushroom.
Wow. Well, are there any religions today that have mushroom ceremonies in any particular culture?
Well, native cultures, you know, and in fact, I've discussed this matter with the head of the Oklavueha Native American Church, who is James Warren Mooney, or James Warren Flying Eagle Mooney, and he says that the Native Americans still very much respect the amanita and the mushrooms, while the church is recognized more profoundly for their use of peyote. It is recognized there, and in fact, he, working with a doctor out of Utah, they've been working together, showing that the Mormon religion was originally founded on both the use of peyote and the Amanita muscaria mushroom, and they've found significant evidence for that. And in fact, I've interviewed the both of them on that topic on my show.
Good heavens. Well, I mean, this is a lot to get into. We're going to find out more about this when we come back, and we're going to take your phone calls right after the break. I want to hear what kind of questions you have there. We're covering a lot of ground here. Astrotheology, shamanism, and the idea of panspermia, the fact that a little tiny spore of a mushroom can be embedded in a stone, a meteorite, and travel through the cold space with all the radiation, break through an atmosphere on some planet, and still be viable. It's been a proven theory for a long time, and this quite possibly is how the universe creates more people, more things. We're talking with Jan Urban more right after the break. You're listening to Coast AM. Yeah, we are back, and we are stirring up a lot of controversy and questions. I'm already getting emails about some of the things that we've covered. We go through a lot of topics and we touch upon so many things that I know it's hard to sort of keep up. You want to sort of Google everything, but it goes by too quick. If you're having trouble, you can always become a Coast Insider, and this way you can go back and review any show. You can even download it and listen to it in your iPod, and this way you can give you a chance to really soak into this material because, you know, this is like a huge library of information that you're not going to get anywhere else. So if you want to get more information on that, it's 15 cents a day, Coast Insider. Just go to coasttocoastam.com, and that will hook you up on everything that you might have missed. And we're going to talk with Jan about this whole idea of mushrooms and how they could have a cosmic significance. And, of course, your questions right after this. We are back talking with Jan Ervin. And just before the break, we were talking about Native American tribes. Do you think that indigenous cultures have a closer relationship to psychoactive substances in their ceremonies than the big, almost corporate mainstream religions?
Oh, absolutely, without a doubt.
Yeah.
You want me to embellish on that?
That's the simple answer. Absolutely. And it makes sense because, I mean, any group of people that are closer to the earth would incorporate, you know, things from the earth in a much more, you know, normal way, I guess. I mean,
right. But when you bring that up, Rob, it reminds me that a lot of people will say, well, you know, anything that you consume from outside you couldn't possibly lead to a real spiritual experience. And, you know, and that's one of the most common things that I hear from people when I do a large radio interview. And if you imagine that for a minute that, you know, the plants really give us our life, because without plants, the animals don't eat anything. And whether or not you're a vegetarian or a meat eater, you run out of food pretty soon and there's no life. So plants really give us our consciousness and our lives. So why not, therefore, our consciousness and our religious experience along with it? And, you know, that humankind has made a connection with the plants to have these religious experiences throughout history. And it's not saying that you can't achieve it with meditation or drumming and other practices as well, but we don't even know for certain if, you know, meditating and using substances like different types of mushrooms even lead to the same type of experience. How can you have a mushroom experience with peyote or a peyote experience with meditation, if you see what I mean?
Well, I know that we are capable of a lot of different states of consciousness. And
absolutely,
some of them are socially acceptable and others are less than. In fact, some of them are just illegal. These psychoactive mushrooms are illegal in the United States and many other countries too, right?
Right. And in fact, well, Amanita muscaria are legal here in the United States. And in fact, you know, there's certain places where you can go and buy them legally, and you can go out and hunt them in the forest and nobody will bother you. But other types, the psilocybe mushrooms, are particularly illegal in this country. They used to be legal in Holland, but a couple of years ago they were outlawed, I think, even for the locals there, but there may be some exceptions. But basically, you know, you have one death from somebody who's a foreigner going on vacation in Holland and having mushrooms and jumping off a bridge. Meanwhile, probably that same evening, several hundred people died under the influence of alcohol and suicides or murder or violent behavior, car accidents, etc. And yet alcohol wasn't outlawed. So it's, you know, the balance or the ratio between the level of punishment and the laws compared to the damage done is significantly out of whack.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of questions, but the phone lines are blowing up. Let's jump right into them. Let's go east of the Rockies. Scott from Appleton, Wisconsin. Welcome to Coast to Coast AM.
Thank you, Mr. Simone. And I'm enjoying being on Coast to Coast one more time. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question and a comment for your guest. He mentioned Buckminster Fuller. My question is, though, does he think the iconography and the symbolism of the Muslim mosques, their more or less mushroom shape, is part of this mushroom in scriptural texts, and also the part on Buckminster Fuller. If you ever saw a dandelion just before it's going to spread its spores, if you look at the mushroom, at the dandelion, it looks like a geodesic dome. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Scott. What do you think?
In regards to his first question and Muslim symbolism, myself and others have certainly suggested that the mosques, et cetera, are related to the mushrooms. And certainly they do look like it. And much of the symbolism in the mosques is based on sacred geometry of the quadrivium. And if people are interested in finding out more on that, there is a book put out by Wooden Books specifically on Islamic design and how it ties into the quadrivium. But there are groups, in fact, in Afghanistan that still practice the use of the Amanita muscaria today. And in fact, the raven's bread or raven's brat is something that is still recognized as the Amanita muscaria in these parts of the world. So it's very possible that that the allusion that this caller made is correct there. And regarding the geodesic dome and the flower that he talks about with Buckminster Fuller, I haven't seen that exact correlation, but it wouldn't surprise me a bit, because when you get into studying the quadrivium and sacred geometry and this type of information, you begin to see how the information is really everywhere. And basically, Buckminster Fuller had a very solid education in the trivium and quadrivium, which is how he was able to come up with the theories and work that he did.
Yeah, so much of what we see is inspired by nature, of course. It's all around. Well, let's go west of the Rockies. Murray from Leavenworth, Washington. Welcome to Coast to Coast AM.
Hello. I just wanted to point out something about peyote. It happens to be a cactus, not a mushroom. And I don't know where he got the idea that peyote was a mushroom, but it's not.
We never said it was a mushroom.
Oh, yeah? Okay. It just implied.
I made a correlation that the Mormon church, that the head of the Oklubueha Native American Church, James Warren Mooney, and a doctor out of Utah were looking at peyote and the mushroom as part of the origins of the Mormon religion.
I see.
Yeah, thanks, Mark.
I busted two young men for 40 pounds of peyote that they were going to process.
Okay.
And well, peyote is a very ancient religious sacrament, and it's still held sacred in many parts of North America today by many. Well, there's at least 200,000 or 300,000 practitioners of the Native American Church.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks, Murray. That's just good to clarify that. Well, let's go to the wild card line, shall we? Let's go to Alan in Ogden, Utah. Welcome to Coast to Coast AM.
Oh, hello. Thank you. Yeah, I was listening to Ian Punnett not too long ago talking about kind of similar subjects, and it came up briefly that Stilton, which is a blue cheese from England, produces not a exactly a drug effect, but it really enhances dreams. It gives you very vivid dreams, and I've tried it, and it does. Oh. And I'm wondering if this would be in the same category, you know, or maybe a milder version of what the guest is talking about.
How about that, Jan?
I've never looked into that. I do know a number of mycologists that would be able to answer that question better than I, but I would have to look into that before I could give a good answer on that.
Mm-hmm. All right. How about one more wild card line? Josh in Hollywood, California. Welcome to Coast AM.
Hey, hi, guys. How you doing?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, man. Good. I always knew it that the high priest was up to no good. I'm going to start my own church. It's called the Church of the Magic Mushroom, and we're going to listen to Jimi Hendrix, Axis Boulder's Love. We're going to listen to the Beatles. Going to listen to Pink Floyd, And, you know, and everybody's going to just feel very entertained, you know, because I think ancients really entertained themselves with this stuff. I mean, where did they get all this, you know, pragmatic and dogmatic stuff? And then it all becomes like, you know, the mind control and stuff, man. That's really spooky, you know. So,
well, there's recreational uses, and then there's uses for religious or ceremony. And they're different. Yeah, different categories.
Right. Well, you know, and even the recreational use can be, it becomes questionable because we only have recreational use because we've removed the spiritual use and the spiritual teachings, the traditional uses of these things from the knowledge of the masses of the people. And then what happens is many of these kids will go to rave parties and things like that, and they'll think that they're doing it recreationally, and they'll have a very deep spiritual experience very often by accident with these substances. So, you know, the dividing line between recreational use and spiritual use is a very, very thin one.
Yeah. These are powerful, dangerous things, and they are not to be tamper with lightly. Let's go to the first time caller line, Chico, California. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Hey guys, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I really liked the conversation tonight, and I started studying some of this stuff about a year ago this time. Kind of just came my way, and I really got into it. But, you know, one of the things that I was questioning was, you know, how would the guests interpret the Shroud of Turin, you know, with the fact that Jesus' story is kind of a combination of a lot of different prophets over the years, and different religious figures. You know, Shroud of Turin is kind of a controversial thing, and I remember hearing the explanation of it, and it seemed that, you know, there was no other way that it could have been created other than some kind of energy force passing through it. So I was just curious about what Jen's interpretation of that would be.
Yeah.
But I don't really give the Shroud of Turin much weight at all, and a lot of those theories are based on a heavy amount of fallacious arguing, and arguing the arbitrary for that matter. And first, that they would have, you know, they would have to prove some spiritual energy. They would have to prove that it wasn't just a cloth laid over a body. There's been many shrouds that have turned up over the years in many places across Europe, and I think the Shroud theory has been well debunked by many professional scholars out there, as well as independent scholars. And I you know, unless you're studying the History Channel and, you know, that kind of stuff, which I don't, you know, the History Channel has lost a lot of credence for the material that they put forward over the last couple of years, I really wouldn't put much weight in it at all.
Well, do you think that the story of Jesus has any artifacts that are hard to disprove?
You know, not really. And I mentioned a number of authors earlier who have gone into a lot of that. I know that there are academics who would disagree with me. At the same time, these academics need to deal with the mushroom information, need to deal with the archaeoastronomy information, need to deal with a lot of the evidence that shows the amalgamation of these many different characters and facets of the religion before I would say that it's based on this one historical figure. I've been studying religions and reading academic journals and books on this subject for 20 years, and I still have yet to see an argument that convinced me that Jesus was a historical person.
Even the sword of destiny, the sword of Longinus carried by Charlemagne and Constantine into victory and Hitler, does that particular artifact think that there might be something to that?
You mean that, you know, the one that Constantine created the rokai with to represent the Catholic Church?
The sword that pierced Jesus' side that so many great rulers sought after and carried with them.
Okay, and so what was your question about the sword?
Well, do you think that artifact has any credibility?
Well, I would have to see it. I mean, you know, where is this artifact? First, I would like to see it. Second, how do we know that it's the spear that pierced Jesus' side?
Yeah, no, obviously there's a lot of questions around it. It is one of those artifacts that has a real place in history. And I thought that one might have piqued your interest.
The thing is it's not on me. I can't prove a negative, okay? It's on these people that want to make these claims about the spear, about the Shroud of Turin and things like that. The onus of proof is on them to supply the evidence beyond any shadow of a doubt, answering all of these little questions and minute possibilities and covering all of the loopholes. The onus of proof is on them, and until they've done so, it's arguing the arbitrary, and it's just an argument. You know, when you get in and you study logic in these things, it's not an argument that you spend time on. You consider it as a possibility, but you don't give it much more credence than that.
Yeah, you can't cover
the person making the argument.
Yeah, you can't cover everything. Let's go to Wildcard Line, Doug, Oakland, California. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you, George, and thank you. I'm interested in what your guest is saying.
Well, George isn't here, but...
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Mark, right?
Rob.
Rob.
Yeah.
Okay. Rob, I ask that you please examine two important figures, historians, one Josephus, another Ramsey, an archaeologist of the 19th century. Josephus was current to Christ, but let me just say something about Ramsey first. Please examine him. He was a 19th century archaeologist. He set out to disprove the writer. He set out to disprove Luke Acts, the writer. He wanted to show that Luke was not a historian whose statements could be relied upon. He ends up calling Luke an historian of the highest pedigree. And the test that he would use was that you take a sample of facts, because you can't test all the facts and acts in Luke, and if it ends up that the sample is reliable, then you draw the inference that all of the historical facts can be relied upon. Let me just give you one example. Doomvirs. Have you studied Greek?
You're asking Jan?
Okay. The term for governor, doomvirs, was not found. They could only find the other term, which was archaeo something. But they did eventually find that term, doomvirs, on some kind of a monument. And so that's just one example of the many facts that not all the facts. You might only be able to test 7 or 8 or 9% of the facts that are in those two books. But when you come up with a reliable on those facts, then you draw the inference that this is a historian whose statements are statements that can be relied upon, and he's a reliable authority.
Really,
and Josephus also was
course.
A current historian to Christ. He had access to current observers of Christ. He was with Trajan when Trajan destroyed Israel, knocked down the temple and all that. He confirms all the basic points of the gospel. So would you please read Ramsey and Josephus?
Okay. Well, let's see what, Doug, you make some good points there. Jan, you have any thoughts on that?
I haven't studied Ramsey, so I wouldn't be able to comment on those citations specifically. But, you have to, when you make associations, you also have to rule out all other possibilities. As far as Josephus, Tacitus, and many of these others, many, many, many biblical scholars have questioned the veracity of Josephus since the early 1800s. There are bookfuls of scholars out there who have completely argued that all of the, just the way that the paragraphs are written in the Josephus text that relate to Jesus, for instance, the flow of a certain paragraph will be completely mixed up with a sudden mention of Jesus in there. And if you remove this mention of Jesus, suddenly the original flow of the text returns. And I know many people bring up Josephus, but Josephus is not a historian that many academic scholars don't already contest for more than 200 years already.
Well, that is a good point. We'll have to just keep it right there for just a moment while we reflect on all of this. We're talking with Jan Ervin. His website is linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. We're talking about the Holy Mushroom, evidence of mushrooms and paganism and Christianity and so much more. Your phone calls right after the break.